Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Boulder Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. The subject of tonight's program is an update, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security, and other retired American issues. With us, a very special guest from before, Richard Fiesta, Executive Director, Alliance for Retired Americans, Washington, D.C. Rich, great to have you back again. Thank you.
Thank you, Dennis, and always great to be back with you.
Let's start with some background questions we normally do. Rich, as in the past, for this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members, could you explain and discuss who is the Alliance for Retired Americans, when it was formed, and its ongoing mission?
Be glad to, Dennis. Yep, the AFL-CIO Executive Council formed the Alliance for Retired Americans in 2001. To be the voice for not only retired union members, but to advocate in general on retiree issues. I mean, we're organized by state chapters. The various AFL-CIO affiliates participate with us for their retirees. Our mission is to advocate for better health, safety, and retirement security for all Americans, starting with our membership. If you want to learn more about us, our website is www.retiredamericans.org. We also have a Facebook page, and many of our state chapters have websites and Facebook pages as well. Our national membership now nationwide is about 4.4 million members, so we consider ourselves advocacy and grassroots-based.
Whoa, that's a great number. Rich, let's do some more update. Could you briefly describe your extensive duties working, lobbying 100 U.S. senators and 435 members of the U.S. House of Representatives as you and your staff advocate for all retired Americans in the United States?
Yeah, we can't do it alone with a small staff in the AFL-CIO building in Washington. So we are working with our states, our grassroots members, and our state chapters to tell their U.S. members of Congress and the House and the Senate where we are on our positions on legislation on issues like, I know we're going to talk about Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, prescription drug prices, minimum wage, the ability to organize, pension issues as well. So it keeps us busy. We have a variety of ways of doing it. You know, in person is always the best, but we send out emails asking our members to do a letter, pass-through letter sometimes to send to your member of Congress's office as well, in addition to visiting. So we have a lot of tools, and we have a lot of activists around the country. So that's how we try to be effective.
Rich, how has this effort for you, your staff, those in AFL-CIO changed, if any, with the 2018 election results?
Well, 2018, Dennis, made a big difference in the way we do our work. As you know, the Democrats took over the House and Nancy Pelosi became Speaker again, so we're not fighting as much, certainly not in the House. We're on the offense. We're not fighting cutting Social Security and Medicare or trying to have beating back 80-plus votes against repealing the Affordable Care Act. So we're getting good things done, like, you know, raising the minimum wage. H.R. 3, commend that to your listeners, too, a bill to bring down drug prices by allowing Medicare to negotiate. A number of these things have already passed the House, and they're sitting on Mitch McConnell's desk stalled. So our efforts, at least in the House, have been positive, and we're getting positive and good pro-retiree legislation. And now it's on to the Senate.
Rich, how many Alliance for Retired American chapters are there in the United States? And could you briefly discuss their great lobbying, their respective state legislators?
Yeah, we have 39 chapters throughout the country, including Colorado, where we have about 36,000 members. And as you said, they do a lot of work, not only talking to their federal delegations, their members of Congress and their senators, but also do a lot of work in state capitals, because a lot of federal and senior programs are joint between the federal government and the states. Medicaid is maybe the best example of that, or a lot of programs where the funding may come from Washington is administered through the states, like the Meals on Wheels program, for example. So there's a lot of things that happen in the state legislatures that affect the daily lives for seniors. Transportation is another one, for example. Our state chapters are active not only on federal legislation, but what's happening in their own state and communities as well.
Rich, I'll just share this with you as I've had in the past. As a member, me, of the Colorado Alliance for Retired Americans, I can give witness that their work at the Colorado State Legislature is exceptionally good. And the two primary examples I think of is Sarah Ghilardi and Mona Moffitt. So with that said...
Yes. Mm-hmm. Thank you, Dennis.
Yeah, so with that said, let's move into Medicaid. Rich, what is Medicaid and how has it benefited millions of American seniors, retirees included as well, since it was implemented with the Social Security amendments of 1965, creating Medicaid by adding Title 19 to the Social Security Act?
Yeah, Medicaid is, as I mentioned earlier, a federal, state, jointly run program, jointly funded program, to help people get health care on the basis of their income. It's for either individuals or families whose income is such that they can't afford insurance and then go through their Medicaid program in their states. And there's great variation on what that line is for income state by state. There are core elements of health care that have to be provided nationwide, but then some states can add on other benefits as well if they so choose. So it'll be 55 years old, like Medicare, this coming month, and it's provided millions of people, especially children, and also older Americans who are in nursing homes, vital health care that they need.
Rich, I have down here, I think I've asked you this before, are all states required to participate?
No, that's the surprising thing. It's not a mandate that states participate in Medicaid. And in fact, the last state to create a Medicaid program was Arizona in 1982. You know, this is a program and a law that was passed in 1965. So it took until 1982 until there was a Medicaid program in all 50 states.
Great. Rich, how has the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, significantly expanded both eligibility for and federal funding of Medicaid?
Yep, this is, again, the state-federal partnership in it is that the states had the ability to expand their Medicaid program to cover more individuals with the federal government at first picking up 190 and then 90 to 100% of the extra cost. Not all the states have done it, only about half had. But it has been a significant expansion of health care coverage since 2010.
How has this assisted senior retired Americans, especially those living at or below the poverty levels?
Well, it has expanded their access, and seniors who qualify for Medicaid and who need to go into a nursing facility, skilled nursing facility as they call it, but it's a nursing home, can take advantage of whatever their state offers on Medicaid in particular. It's also helped with prescription drug costs, whether or not you're in a nursing home, too.
How have attacks by the Trump administration and the U.S. Congress contributed to dramatically decreasing and/or eliminating these benefits?
Well, that's been a problem since 2017. The Trump administration's budgets every year have had huge cuts to Medicaid and Medicare that would be trillions over 10 years. And people, especially for seniors who need more health care and rely on health care coverage older in their lives, have seen many benefits. Some states have had to cut back their optional benefits, you know, something maybe like dental or something like that. just to fund the core benefits. So it's been very difficult the last couple of years.
Rich, thank you for that with everything with Medicaid. So let's move on into Medicare. So as per our past interviews, let's continue the education process with Medicare for this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members. So with that said, what is Medicare and how has it benefited millions of older Americans since it was signed into law by President Lyndon Baines Johnson, LBJ, on July 30th, 1965? And we're coming up on an anniversary of 55 years.
Right. And we at the Alliance every year on July 30th for Medicare and Medicaid and August 14th for Social Security. We do events all around the country in our chapters. I know our Colorado people do that. And oftentimes they'll bring a cake to the local Social Security office saying thank you. Have a member of Congress come to one of their meetings, or we'll go to the member of Congress's office. Although this year we're doing a lot of it virtual on the internet. But it's very important. Medicare was enacted in 1965 to be old age health care for people over 65 or people who are disabled under 65. This is something private insurance couldn't cover. Insurance companies weren't going to write policies for health care on older Americans. So it's a large program, 50 million or so people in it. We pay our premiums through our workplace that our employers match, and it provides basic coverage, hospitalization, and your doctor's visits, and Part D for drugs was added in 2003. So it is America's old age health insurance program.
Rich, like I always like to do. I'm a stat guy and to a certain extent with these programs. So how is Medicare funded?
Yeah, Medicare is funded through the payroll deductions. An employee pays 1.45% of his or her wages. That 1.45% is matched by employers, and unlike Social Security, there's a cap when you stop paying. For Medicare, there is no cap, so 1.45% plus 1.45% on every dollar earned.
So there is no cap. So with that said, what could be some positive solutions with this issue for all present and future Medicare recipients without compromising the present level of benefits?
Well, we could do a lot more in savings in the program. One of the quieter but most effective parts of the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, was really finding a lot of savings in the programs on the provider side, not the beneficiary side. There are a lot of inefficiencies on reimbursement rates, more competitive programs in marketing and in terms of going to the government and providing medical equipment, for example, and also better attacks on fraud as well. The Obama administration was exceptional between the Medicare program and the Justice Department on going after cheaters, and oftentimes hundreds of millions of dollars in Medicare fraud as well. So we can do a lot better. The financial health, the Medicare program, trust fund was in trouble in 2010 when Obamacare was passed, that it was going to run out of money by 2016. That's been pushed originally to 2030, but what some of these cutbacks in the Trump administration have done, they've moved it backwards the wrong way to 2026. So we have to be vigilant and always look for new ways for both savings as our baby boomers retire and better efficiencies as well.
Rich, what about the future? And I'm talking about in the context of Medicare for all. Has that got any legs at all in the U.S. Congress?
Well, clearly not for this Congress. I mean, we're in July before the end, and since we know one party controls one House and the other party controls the other, I think it's been a robust debate over the last 10 years on a national health insurance, and the easy phrase is Medicare for all. I think at first, frankly, we have to come with a common definition of what Medicare for all means. Is it just expanding the Medicare program, or is it more of a national health insurance program like a lot of our economic friends and competitors in Europe and Canada and Japan, Australia have as well? So short term, we're kind of where we are with our programs. Long term, in the next Congress and next president, it's open for debate.
All right then, Rich, let's move into you're doing very well with everything here, so moving right along. So let's go to Social Security. So as before, and again for this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members, what is Social Security, and how has it benefited millions of older Americans, many others as well, since it was signed into law by President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on August 14th, 1935, and I believe we're coming up on 85 years.
That's right. 55 and 85 for Medicare and Social Security this year. It's easy to do that in the 0 years and 5 years. Social Security is America's, basically, I call it America's national family insurance policy. The most largest and well-known is, of course, the old age retirement feature of it. But it provides security for families. If a worker dies in his or her working life, that it will provide benefits for children up to the age of 18, and we're trying to get that extended up to 21, 22 through college, the way it was until 1981. If your spouse dies, whoever had the higher benefit gets that as well. So it's a survivor's and a dependents program, as well as an old age retirement program. And it is run beautifully and efficiently. Less than 1% of the Social Security operating trust fund is towards administration. And in fact, everybody who works for the Social Security Administration is paid out of the trust fund. So the rest of our government dollars and revenues aren't propping it up. So in some ways, it may be the best national program that America has ever created.
I agree. But with that, Rich, let's talk about funding. Because everyone says it's running out of money. But how is Social Security funded? Payroll deduction, matched by employers? Go ahead.
Yeah. Like Medicare, and it came first, it is a payroll deduction, 6.2% of your wages, matched by another 6.2% by your employer, up to, and it's on a sliding scale formula, and for 2020, it is $137,700. So above that, you or your employer don't pay Social Security withholding, but you still will, for example, with Medicare. So that is how it's funded, and it's in good shape until the trustees say till 2034. At which time, of course, money would still be coming in because people are working. And if Congress does nothing, then you would have to reduce benefits because the surplus it now has would be gone, and it would just be relying on the day-to-day money coming in.
Rich, how can Social Security expand benefits for millions of Americans, extend the lifespan of the trust fund, and pay for it by asking the wealthy to pay their fair share into Social Security? And you know where I'm going with this. I always bring it up to you before you or your answer is that I'm a huge proponent of scrap the cap, like you already mentioned.
Yeah, this is an easy fix for Social Security. And a lot of it is due to working people's wages being flat over the last 30 years. It traditionally was that if you added everybody's wages up, somebody working part-time for minimum wage up to a millionaire or billionaire who was making wages, if you added everybody's up in the whole workforce, traditionally you get some very large number, trillions, and 90% of all those wages were captured by the cap below, and we're subject to the Social Security tax. Well, since all the wage increases over the last 30 years have gone to the top 5% or less, it used to be instead of 90% of all wages being covered by Social Security's tax, now we're down to about 80%. So that is one easy way, is just to move the cap up or scrap it altogether over time, which would be even easier. And we could fund Social Security basically for the rest of this century. And then you could actually raise benefits, because Social Security benefits, even compared to our economic competitors, are relatively modest. The average benefit's only about $15,000 a year. And if you're a woman, who oftentimes women paid less in and out of the workforce more, theirs is only average around $13,000 a year. So it's not enough money to live on if that's the basis of your retirement income.
Rich, could you give, you already talked about it a little bit earlier, but I want you to repeat it. Could you give an update on the recent Social Security Trustees Annual Report?
Yes, the Social Security Trustees Report earlier this year in 2020 said that the fund is fine until 2034. There are actually two accounts in the one fund, the one for retirees and survivors and dependents, and then one for disability, because during the 50s, during the Eisenhower administration with a Democratic Congress, disability was added to Social Security, and that's a smaller part of our 6.2%. It's fine for a couple decades beyond 2034. So the trust fund currently has a $2.9 trillion, that's with a T, surplus. Because back in the 80s, the last time the tax was raised, of course, everyone knew that the baby boomers would start retiring around 2010. So they upped the tax rate to this part of our nation's history we're in now with the baby boomers retiring so they could get their benefits. So that will eventually run down, currently projected at the year 2034.
Thank you, Rich. We have about, I guess, 5 minutes left, and so let's get into a summary. And I always like to ask this question, and you do great with it, and it's called, quote-unquote, Inside the Beltway. Could you explain and educate this KGNU listening audience with your personal perspective from inside the Beltway? Why are these programs, Medicaid, Medicare, and Social Security, real targets for extremely reduced funding, possibly elimination based on the need to offset the $2 to $3 trillion deficit created by the enormous tax cut for the wealthy in the looming 2020 or 2021 budget proposals by the Trump administration and the U.S. Congress?
Well, thanks for the question, Dennis, and that's what we at the Alliance for Retired Americans concern ourselves with almost every day. I mean, from the passage of Social Security in 1935 through Medicare and Medicaid in 65 through the present, there's always been an element in society at large, a small one for the most part, but especially in politics, that don't believe that these programs should exist, that everyone should just be out there on your own, that if you're 75 years old, you ought to be able to go out to a private insurance company and buy a health insurance policy. Well, of course, that's not the case, or that somehow you, while you were raising a family and paying a mortgage on a house, you could somehow save money on your own, you know, and therefore we don't need Social Security. Well, that's just crazy as well. But there are extremists, many of whom have gone into leadership in Congress over the last 20 years that have made this the target, and in the current case in the White House, where we get budgets every year, cutting hundreds of millions of dollars, $500 billion out of Medicare and Medicaid each year. And as you pointed out, the right thing is we just had this very skewed to the top wealthy tax cut in 2017 that we're living through now, that is ballooning our deficit, giving money to corporations that don't even pay taxes to the United States, American corporations that first place don't pay taxes are now getting handouts, as you will. And we've seen it this year, too, in some of this relief for the pandemic. And now we're being asked that, oh, we can't afford Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security anymore. Well, that's why we have elections, and that's why we go to the polls, for example, to fight back on that. And it is incumbent, I think, on all of us to vote this year, get our families out this year, learn the issues, and especially where the candidates are, because sometimes you see these candidates, oh, I love Medicare, I love Social Security, but then you look at their voting record, and we at the Alliance for Retired Americans do an annual voting record for each member of the U.S. Senate and the U.S. House. So I encourage you to visit our website, retiredamericans.org, and see where your members of Congress have voted on retiree issues. We do 10 votes from the House and the Senate each year, and you can go back to a member of Congress's career from the time he or she entered Congress and see where they are. And because they'll love to send out letters saying, oh, I'm really for Social Security and we need it to be there. And then you look and they're voting to cut it or voting to change the COLA that makes it lower. Same with Medicare and Medicaid as well. So being educated and fighting back against people who want to cut, but at the same time being proactive, like tell your member we need to scrap the cap on Social Security and Medicaid, on Social Security. And on Medicare, we need Medicare to negotiate for prescription drugs on behalf of nearly 50 million people because we know we would get better and lower drug prices. You know, Americans pay the highest drug prices in the world, and that hasn't happened by accident. And a lot of these drugs were created with seed money from our tax dollars at the National Institutes of Health and the like. And then nonetheless, there's no way to recoup that, and drug companies can just run off, develop drugs, set a price, whatever they think a market will bear, and then the rest of us are forced to pay, and in some cases, just outrageous prices. We see this on the news every week for medicines that started with our tax dollars. So resist and fight back. Join us. Visit our website, but be active.
Rich, that's almost like a conclusion, but I'm still going to give you another minute to, maybe expand on that or add to that. And so do you have any final thoughts or comments for this KGNU listening audience in the context of tonight's subject, update, Medicaid, Medicare, Social Security,
and
other
retirement? This year, Dennis, is more important than any others. We know it's an election year, and they're very important races up and down the ballot. And in Colorado, not only the president, you have a U.S. Senate race, your members of Congress, legislature, and the like there as well. So there is no excuse, especially in Colorado, which is one of the few states that's doing the right thing, voting by mail, making voting easy. I just read last week the governor is telling them the Election Bureau they're going to put even more drop boxes out around the state so that you don't have to get out of your car in a pandemic. It makes it easier to take your ballot, put it in the mail, and have it counted. And in states like Colorado, there's no excuse not to vote, to get your family members voting, getting them and yourself educated on issues. That, I think, this year, it's the middle of July, and we only have 3 months or so left. It's time to do it. And this year, perhaps more important than any time in the recent past, it's that much important to get out, get active, get voting.
All right, then. Rich, thank you for being on Labor Exchange at KGNU. As always, you did a great job. And the election, of course, is Tuesday, November 3rd. If anybody has any comments about this show or any other show on KGNU, please call 303-447-9911. And next week, Monday, July 27th, 2020, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. This has been Labor Exchange, and I am Dennis Kreese for KGNU Community Radio.